Today, we speak to the college dropout who began breaking international news stories from his front room, ranging from Syria to Skripal to MH17. And Jonathan Friedland on Theresa May's second meaningful vote.
I've just been running a workshop all day with ITN.
So ITN are paying you to run a workshop for their journalists?
Yeah. And which is ironic because I actually applied for their training course back in 2013.
No. Yeah. And they said no to you?
Yeah, and the BBC. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, the BBC actually now have some...
You didn't apply to The Guardian?
I didn't. I think I just gave up. My hopes were crushed. Just commenting on the live blogs constantly on The Guardian, just hoping you'd notice me and elevate me.
You may not have heard of Elliot Higgins, the founder of the investigative website Bellingcat, but you'll know his work. You uncovered the identity of the Skripal poisoning suspects. You exposed the use of cluster bombs during the Syrian civil war. You showed how a Russian military missile was responsible for shooting down the MH17 flight over eastern Ukraine in 2014. And you confirmed the identity of violent white supremacists at Charlottesville. All from a laptop in your front room in Leicester?
Generally on my sofa.
Fully dressed.
Yeah, fully dressed.
Bellingcat was set up in 2014 and has been responsible for revealing key aspects of some of the biggest stories of the past 5 years. Higgins works with professional and citizen journalists around the world to uncover facts that are hiding in plain sight. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how a college dropout began breaking huge international stories from his front room. Even before Elliot Higgins found his way into investigative journalism, he was spending a lot of time on the internet.
I was kind of a very shy nerd, I guess you could call me. I was kind of more interested in computer games than kind of socializing. And as the internet became more popular, I was kind of one of the early adopters, I suppose.
What did you play?
I was playing online games like Ultima Online and World of Warcraft. In a way, that kind of taught me how to work with people remotely across the world for killing big monsters rather than investigating crimes. But in a way, it's the same kind of principles where you have to figure out who can do what and where the skills are. And that's, in a way, what we kind of do with Bellingcat. I actually started doing this when I was commenting on the Guardian Middle East live blog, basically to win arguments on the live blog. So it was 2011 and Libya was kind of the main focus of international attention.
We saw a 20mm anti-aircraft cannon firing directly into the front of our convoy.
And there were all these videos and photographs that were coming out and people were kind of debating whether or not you could trust them. And I started thinking, well, how can you figure out if you can trust them?
Just some glimpses of the brutal reaction to protests in Libya now turning up on the internet.
I saw a video and it was the rebels claiming they'd captured this town. And I saw there was a mosque, it was next to this road and it was a very wide road. So I looked at the town and found this wide road and then found the mosque and then found all the little buildings and trees around it on satellite imagery. And that verified that the video was filmed where they claimed it was. And that was kind of the start of it. Then my daughter was born in late 2011. Basically, everything went out the window. It's my first child. So I was really busy for a few months. And we got into a routine. I thought, I want to start a hobby where I can kind of pick up and put down something quickly. And I thought, well, maybe I'll start blogging about some of these videos and just for my own kind of entertainment. And it was really just for me more than anyone else.
And you were writing under the name Brown Moses at the time.
Well, Brown Moses is a Frank Zappa song, which inspired one of my online pseudonyms. Actually, when I was commenting on the Guardian live blog, that's the name I was commenting over. So there was kind of a lot of discussion about who I really was early on. I don't think anyone kind of expected the answer that they got.
Did you love the secrecy of that? Do you love writing under a pseudonym?
Not really. I kind of love not being personally harassed by crazy people, which is kind of what happens now. But it was part of kind of my evolution, I guess, is kind of moving into the mainstream more. So I was asked to write an article for Foreign Policy. They basically said you had to write under your real name. So that was kind of the first time I did that and used my real name. But it was in early 2013 where kind of my true identity really took off. I did an investigation looking at weapons in videos that were being published by the Syrian rebels, and it turned out they were all from Croatia. And they'd been smuggled there by the Saudis. And the rebels were just filming all these weapons and putting them onto YouTube. And I was looking at them and figuring out who was getting them. And then I took that to someone I knew at the New York Times, and it ended up on the front page.
What is the difference between open source investigation and journalistic investigation?
There's always been kind of open source investigation. It's basically anything that's publicly available. What's different now is we have all this online material, and it's a vast amount of it. With the development of things like smartphones and the rise of social media apps and the creation of sites like Google Earth, Google Maps, Street View, we have all this information coming from people, and we have all this information now that can be used as reference images. So you can kind of cross-reference it and actually figure stuff out from it. I just kind of saw this and thought, well, maybe we can find some stuff out.
So how did you start Bellingcat?
Bellingcat came about in early 2014. I wanted to launch a new website because there was a lot of people doing open source investigation who weren't quite getting the same attention I was, plus a place where I could write about the techniques I was using to do investigations.
And why did you call it Bellingcat?
Well, I was trying to come up with a clever name, and I am very bad at coming up with clever names. So I was thinking of stuff like, oh, theopensource.com. And they were either...
Sounds really slappy.
They were so terrible, or they'd already been taken. So I know Peter Jukes, the writer, and I did some stuff on the phone hacking scandal, so we'd met through that. And I called him up, and he's the most creative person I could think of. And he said, what about Belling the Cat?
We need to know where she is at all times.
And Belling the Cat is a fable about a group of mice who are very scared of a cat. So one of them comes up with an idea to put a bell on the cat's neck. So I thought, well, that could actually be quite good. I looked at bellingthecat.com, and it was $4,000 to register it because someone had domain parked it, and bellingcat.com was $40. So I went with Bellingcat. And that was launched on July 14th, 2014, which was just 3 days before MH17 was shot down in eastern Ukraine, which then became one of our biggest investigations and something we still even today are investigating.
A Malaysian airliner with 295 people on board crashes in eastern Ukraine. We'll be live across the world assessing the impact of this disaster.
So tell us about that investigation.
July 17th, 2014, I started seeing posts on social media where people were talking about an aircraft being shot down, and it became apparent it was a commercial aircraft, which obviously was going to be a huge news story. And immediately there started being photographs and videos being shared showing various things. Some claimed to show MH17 being shot down. Turned out they were just old videos. Some of it showed a Buk missile launcher moving through what was claimed to be eastern Ukraine.
A video that appeared on social media apparently showing an SA-11 missile launcher heading back to Russia and missing at least one missile.
One of the first big things we came across with MH17 was we were able to show that a missile launcher that had been filmed in Russia in June in a part of a convoy from the 53rd Air Defense Brigade in Kursk in Russia was the same missile launcher that was filmed in Ukraine on July 17th and linked to the shooting down of MH17. So we were one of the first organizations that showed this clear link between the Russian Federation and what happened on July 17th.
And your techniques are pretty amazing. I mean, you're looking at pictures on social media and then you're matching them with information from other sites. You're geolocating people. I mean, you're featured in this new documentary, Bellingcat, Truth in a Post-Truth World. And when I was watching it, there was one point where you were literally matching a shadow on Google Earth with a picture of a truck. And I thought, surely this isn't real.
Well, there was one very interesting video. It was published 2 years after MH17 was shot down, and it shows this convoy that this missile launcher was part of with other vehicles. And it's on the back of this transport truck. It just happened a satellite was passing over that same location within minutes, maybe even seconds of that film being made, and it caught that same convoy in that same position. And it's very hard to see if you don't know what you're looking for, but it was, you know, a rare occasion where something was filmed on the ground and that exact moment was also captured on a satellite image as well.
And often you're trying to piece together the truth, but sometimes you're showing when things are fake.
One of my favourite examples is the Russian Ministry of Defence tweeted four shots from what appeared to be drone imagery, and they said it was irrefutable evidence that the US was helping ISIS recover their combat capabilities so they could be deployed elsewhere in the Middle East. So they're saying that the US is helping ISIS, and it was irrefutable evidence. The problem was, one of their pieces of irrefutable evidence was a screenshot from a computer game, and we were able to find the computer game footage they took it from. A week earlier, an Indian journalist had posted the same video, and I saw that, and I just kind of quote tweeted it saying, this is actually from a computer game and here's the link. The people who follow me and saw that tweet are the same kind of people who follow the Russian Ministry of Defense's Twitter account. So when the Russian MOD tweeted that, all the replies were people saying, this is a video from a computer game with the link. What then happened is the Russian MOD actually retracted that claim, and they said it was like an intern making a mistake or some ridiculous claim like that. But it's the only time I've seen the Russian MOD retract a statement like that, because they were basically immediately humiliated.
A really big story for you was when Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned in Salisbury in the UK. Eventually, a picture was released of suspects who Russia were suggesting were just tourists visiting the city, and you were able to show were part of the Russian Military Intelligence Service, the GRU. Were you surprised that you were able to uncover their identity?
It wasn't so much that we were surprised we were able to uncover their identity. It was more, as we were doing the investigation, we discovered that the Russian bureaucracy is not set up to cover the identities of GRU officers. One example is we had this driving license registration database we managed to get our hands on. And these kind of databases have been leaked out of the government and sold in markets in Russia for years. So we had the identity of one of these people, and we looked him up and we saw where his car was registered. And it was actually the GRU headquarters in his town. And then we thought, well, why don't we put the address of the GRU headquarters into this database and see how many results we get. And it gave us 305 results of people registered at the GRU headquarters, all potential GRU officers. And the thing is that it allows them to register, and then they can kind of get away with parking fines and stuff like that. So it's just little things like that. We found that the GRU officers, when they occasionally get awarded Hero of Russia Award, which is the highest honor they can get, they also sometimes get given apartments, but it's always in the same building. So we know there's an apartment building in Russia full of GRU officers. One of our volunteer investigators, in fact, he also beforehand had been working on the Montenegro attempted coup, and GRU officer had been arrested there, and his real passport and fake ID was published. And there were some similarities between the two. It had the same birthday, for example. So he had the theory that maybe this was the same with all GRU officers. They used some shared details. And based off that, he was able to start finding information that pointed towards the real identity of these people.
Ruslan Bashirov and Alexander Petrov.
Are those your real names?
Yes, they are our real names.
And how did you feel when you saw the RT interview suggest that they just wanted to see the spire?
There's the famous Salisbury Cathedral, famous not only in Europe, but in the whole world. It's famous for its 123-meter spire.
Well, we already knew at that point that these people were not telling the truth, because we had already done a lot of the research, because it was like a week after the UK released their information. So we were getting ready to publish in like a few days, but then we realized we had to get something out really quickly.
Do you work for the GRU?
And you?
Me? No. And you?
And I don't either.
Where do you work? You're adults who need to make a living.
So in a way, RT actually was a massive boon to what happened to us. If it wasn't for that RT interview, we may not have had so much impact with the stuff we did. So I guess thank you, RT, for once.
We're in the fitness industry.
So listen, we're living in a time when governments are using misinformation and trying to discredit the work of journalists. Since you began blogging as Brown Moses, do you think that situation's got worse?
I mean, I don't know if it's got any worse. I think people are noticing it more. And certainly the Russian Federation's involvement with the US election and maybe Brexit as well. I mean, there's that element to it, but that's kind of more information warfare, maybe not so much disinformation. And whilst kind of Syria in particular was a focus of the initial growth of this way of investigating, now Bellingcat is very much focused on the conflict in Yemen and trying to document that. And we're actually setting up a new research team with a view to using what we gather and what we document in future court cases.
Are you worried about making mistakes? Have you made any?
I worry about making mistakes all the time, and I'm constantly being accused of being wrong about everything. But often when we're writing, we kind of write about our certainty about certain elements of investigation, and there's certain things you can be sure about. There's certain things that sometimes you can be less certain about. There's a video, there's a protest outside the embassy in Washington by pro-Kurdish protesters a year or two ago. And President Erdogan, security forces were there, and they basically attacked the protesters. And you can actually see footage of someone leaning into the car, speaking to someone in this car. He then looks up and talks to someone else with an earpiece, who then runs off and runs across the road and starts attacking these people. And then from the door of the car the guy was talking to, President Erdogan stands up. Now, from that, you might want to say President Erdogan gave that order, but we can only say that that guy was talking to someone in the car and then he came out. We can't say for certain that he gave it. It's probably very, very likely, but it's those different levels of certainty that we work with, and then we can combine this. It's like with MH17. We can say the videos and photographs of this missile launch were filmed in these different locations. We can say, based off social media posts, the timeline of when this was happening. But people come back and say, well, these posts must be fake because it's all a big conspiracy. But you look at stuff like people who are posting about it have been on social media for 4 or 5 years. So it's incredibly unlikely that the SBU in Ukraine set up social media accounts 4 years ago to then be involved with this conspiracy about MH17. So it's really about kind of what is possible and what isn't possible.
I mean, you've said that you just so happen to have come up with things that have been negative for the Russian government on a number of occasions, and that it wasn't a deliberate thing. It just so happened that you ended up there. But you can see why they might feel that they're being targeted.
Yeah, and, you know, I would say to the Russian government, the best thing to do is just stop lying about stuff, because a lie is something that we can look into. It's like with Syria. I do this workshop and I just go through example after example for the Russian Federation making a claim that can be disproved through open source evidence. It's almost like practice now. Russia makes a claim in a press conference, double check it. It's either unverifiable or turns out to be untrue.
And you've been attacked personally by Russian-backed news channel RT and people online. What do they say about you?
Kind of Russian media, Russia Today, Sputnik, even occasionally Russian officials have various stories about us. We've kind of been upgraded. Initially, I was described as an unemployed lingerie salesman, you know, someone who didn't know what they were talking about.
Elliot Higgins, who runs the website Bellingcat, is a laid-off admin worker who made a name for himself by analysing weapons used in the Syrian conflict.
Never been to Syria, doesn't speak a word of Arabic.
We had the ambassador to the UK from Russia saying that we were part of the British deep establishment. He was clearly wanted to say deep state, but he realised that would just make him sound crazy, so he went for establishment. But we have all these claims that we're kind of NATO-backed kind of website, and they love putting NATO backs behind us because then it makes it sound extra spooky. Either we're complete amateurs or we're working for the intelligence services and governments and or somewhere in between, or sometimes both.
Are you NATO-backed?
Not really. I think probably NATO quite likes us for the stuff we're doing on Russia, but yeah, it's not like we're getting checks on them.
How are you funding Bellingcat right now?
Currently, Bellingcat gets grants from foundations. Some of them are like family foundations. Some are like the Open Societies Foundation. And that's about 50% of our budget. The other half comes from workshops that we run. So we run them all over the world now.
Do you think people recognise you walking down the street?
Well, I don't know if they would recognise me walking down the street. I mean, if I started talking about Bellingcat, they might. And I found it increasingly difficult to do public events because you have people turning up and kind of shouting from the audience and claiming I'm kind of a NATO propagandist and stuff like that.
Does that make you nervous when people are doing that?
I mean, those kind of people probably worry me more than being assassinated by the GRU, which seems to be what most people think is going to happen to me.
Well, you don't seem that worried about that.
Well, I think that I'm kind of more concerned that some person on the internet who gets riled up by kind of conspiracy theorists and Russia Today and Sputnik saying that I'm part of this vast global conspiracy against Russia decides to hunt me down.
But, I mean, there's also evidence of Russian government-backed extrajudicial killings. Are you scared of taking on governments in this way?
I'm not. I mean, we're careful. It's like now we're doing this Yemen project. We're very aware that the Saudis aren't going to probably take that lying down if we start writing about their airstrikes, you know, killing civilians. And we're a bit more worried about kind of cybersecurity side of things and our stuff being hacked and accessed. So a big part of our new office is actually having a lot of really good security around our servers. And from a personal security perspective, I mean, there's only really so much you can do in your own life short of, you know, locking yourself away and never coming out.
Do your family worry?
Yeah, I mean, they do, but I think it's become so much part of our life. I mean, I kind of hope in a way that my comparatively high profile, I mean, if I ended up falling down the stairs, everyone is going to assume it's Russia. So it's kind of, you know, even if it's an accident. So it's, maybe that'll put them off, but who knows?
With all this opposition to your work, why do you keep doing it?
I just really enjoy it. I mean, the thing is, there is kind of all this online abuse and stuff like that, but the work we're doing, and a lot of it is done quite quietly, around kind of, you know, using open source information in all kinds of fields, you know, working with international bodies and figuring out how we can take this evidence and turn it into something useful, is extremely satisfying. The best thing we can do at Bellingcat for the people on the ground is kind of take this material and turn it into something that can be used for justice and accountability, the thing they really want.
Elliot, thank you very much.
That's great, thank you.
That was Elliot Higgins. He's featured in a new documentary, Bellingcat: Truth in a Post-Truth World, that opens the Human Rights Watch Film Festival on the Thursday, the 14th of March at the Barbican in London. Coming up, The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland reacts to another major Brexit vote. Welcome back. It was another blow for Theresa May as her Brexit deal fell again in a second meaningful vote of MPs that triggered chaos in Parliament. Now Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland looks at what comes next.
The ayes to the right, 242. The noes to the left, 391. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock.
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker, I profoundly regret the decision that this House has taken tonight. I continue to believe that by far the best outcome is that the United Kingdom leaves the European Union in an orderly fashion with a deal. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that the deal we've negotiated is the best and indeed the only deal available.
I'm in Westminster Hall, having just come out of the chamber at the House of Commons, just turning the little corner into this vast, echoing stone medieval space. And it was very dramatic in there. The government lost by a majority of 149, which wasn't the 230 they lost by in the last meaningful vote, but still a huge figure. 75 Tories voted against, you know, 391 people voted against Theresa May's bill and only 242 for it. So a thumping defeat. And the atmosphere was very grave in there. I mean, I was in the chamber as well in January for the meaningful vote then. And there was a kind of adrenaline and excitement about it because people felt as if, okay, game on. There's lots of options now. This felt like a government and a parliament, actually, politics hitting a wall, running out of road. And it was partly because she had this very hoarse voice. And it seemed a very grave moment, a very somber moment. She then set out what's going to happen next, which is that on Wednesday there is a vote about whether Britain wants to leave the European Union, crash out without any deal. And she announced that it's going to be a free vote, which is an extraordinary concession on her part, or admission, really, is a better word. She was admitting that she has lost control of this process. She was almost saying, it's up to you now. I've come to you with a deal that I think was viable and workable and stable and orderly, and you've rejected it. So now it's on you. And if you want to leave without a deal, you're going to get the chance to vote for that on Wednesday. If you don't want that, you're then going to get a chance to vote on whether you want to extend Article 50 and delay this whole process. And what's really interesting, the thing I just did straight after watching the Commons vote was just listening to a briefing from the Prime Minister's spokesman, and they raise the possibility, or they at least are ready to discuss the possibility, that both of those things get defeated. That Parliament says no to no deal, and then no to extending. In other words, we want, you know, neither the frying pan nor the fire. And that leaves the position of total paralysis, which is really becoming plausible. We're into the same guesswork that we've all been into when we ask ourselves what's going to happen next. Because I often get this, asked by people, well, you know, how's it going to work out? And it's not that there are politicians who know the answer to that, and then we journalists are just on the outside, you know, our faces pressed up against the glass and we're not being told. They themselves don't know. When Theresa May said we're in uncharted waters, I think she was telling the truth about that. They don't know. They're kind of winging it. And the first move is to say free vote on no deal. The assumption is that will go down. You know, there's a hard core of Brexiters who will say yes to crashing out no deal. Jacob Rees-Mogg, that kind of group, the rest don't want to do that. So you assume that goes down. Then there's this thing about extending. And I think there's a lot of MPs who would rather not have it on their voting record that they voted to delay the and thwart the will of the people. So even though they must know practically that it's the only way through this, I just wonder if they won't want to put their names to it. I think Labour will vote for an extension, but are there enough people on the other side? There is already a sense that backbenchers are trying to get a grip on this instead. And there was a very forceful intervention in the House of Commons from Yvette Cooper, who is becoming almost a leader-in-waiting figure around whom, not quite opposition, but those people who want there to be some resolution of this are gathering. And she obviously has some plan in mind about Parliament taking control. But I think what we have witnessed tonight and what is quite historic is a government visibly losing control and sort of passing the baton from itself to MPs and saying, we've done our best, now you do it. And that's quite a profound moment. I think now a lot of people will be taking seriously what Theresa May and others were saying for a while, but which they thought was just scare tactics, which was she constantly was saying to the Brexiters, you either vote for my deal or you may not get Brexit at all. And that was Project Fear, and they're just saying it just to bully us into voting for her terrible deal. That's how the Brexiters responded to that. Now they must be thinking, hold on a minute, that is plausible that we don't get Brexit, because assume, apart from them, the 100 or so perhaps who want no deal, that will be defeated. Then you're into this thing of extension. And I think they must be aware, just because they are politicians, that the nature of delay is once something's delayed, whole new dynamics kick in. It's almost like breaking a taboo. If Brexit does not happen on March the 29th, then it opens up, becomes possible, you know, mentally conceivable. Well, if it's not going to happen on March 29th, why does it happen at all? That question becomes in play. One other thing I was really struck by in the exchanges straight afterwards, Theresa May said, now you, Parliament, have to decide whether you want to extend Article 50, whether you want a second referendum. She raised that as a possibility. And she set out these options. When Jeremy Corbyn got up, he didn't say that. He didn't mention second referendum as a possible scenario. But, you know, but there's the Prime Minister, who's always set her face implacably against a second referendum, now at least admitting it's a possibility. So if I were one of the Brexiters, I would be quite anxious tonight and in the coming days, because I'd be thinking, is there now an unpredictable dynamic in play? Yeah, it could lead us to crashing out, that's what they want, but it could also lead to them not having Brexit at all. And it's why a lot of Conservatives were pleading with their colleagues, saying, for heaven's sake, take yes for an answer. And the story of this event may be that Brexiters didn't grab the prize when they had it almost in their grasp, because it wasn't perfect and shiny enough, and therefore they may lose it altogether.
That's it for today. My thanks to Elliot Higgins and Jonathan Friedland. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.